It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, rising mortgage rates might be cooling off a red-hot housing market, and some economists think we're now in a housing recession. We'll find out what that can mean for housing and housing costs here in Wisconsin. First, according to biologists, there have been 5 known mass extinction events in the history of life on Earth. The last one happened roughly 66 million years ago, when the dinosaurs were most likely wiped out by an asteroid. And it appears there's another one going on right now. The current mass extinction is unique in that its source is largely human activity. The UN Convention on Biological Diversity estimates that about 150 species die off each day, a number that can be difficult to wrap our heads around. Our next guest says there's something that can help us comprehend these extinctions. She takes a close look at the stories of endlings, a word used to mean the last individual left in a species, like Lonesome George, the last Pinta Island tortoise who died in 2012, and Benjamin, the Tasmanian tiger who died in 1933. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is there an endangered species close to your heart? Do you think the current mass extinction can be stopped or slowed down? Have you visited the Passenger Pigeon Memorial here in Wisconsin? Have you done conservation work yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lydia Pine is a writer and historian. Her most recent book is Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Endling was a new word to me, I got to say, Lydia, and it's pretty new in and of itself. Can you talk about the origins of this word endling?
Sure. So, pardon me. So, as you pointed out, an endling is defined as the last known individual of a species before that species goes extinct. And the word sort of came into being around 1996 when biologists were doing conservation work, but also working with people who had come to understand that they were going to be the last of their family, and were looking for a word that would sort of have a poignancy about what it would be to be the end of something. And a couple of different words are tried out in the literatures, but endling is the one that sticks. It's really specific. It's really interesting, and it really piques a kind of curiosity, I think.
A big point of your book is that it matters how we talk about extinction and about these species and their last members. How does the word endling help do that, do you think?
So I think endling is a word that is really easy to gravitate toward. I joke that it took a long time when I was writing the book, it took a long time for Word to stop auto-correcting endling to ending. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a real sort of crossover between endling and ending and sort of how we think about extinction and the ends of things. And I think endling is a word that gives us a character to build out extinction stories around.
You end the book, if you don't mind me spoiling your last line.
No, please.
Quoting here, we owe it to these endlings to tell their stories in as many words and narratives as possible. Why is that?
So when I was digging into the history of endlings and how we talk about these last of their species and these last survivors, I was really struck by how Western-centric these stories are, that we could find echoes of these stories in classic works like Beowulf or the King Arthur legend or all sorts of these sort of classic pieces of literature. And I wanted to, as part of this book, I wanted to be able to expand the kinds of literature and the kinds of words and the kinds of stories that we could use to talk about extinction and hopefully have a richer understanding of what loss means.
One practical hope, I think, for talking about these endlings, these last members of their species, would be, I guess, a cautionary tale. We have lots of those in the history of stories here. Something that tells us, hey, by the time it's gotten to this last one, it's too late, and maybe inspires us to care for other species. That's just one narrative. Is that an important one, though?
I think it is. I see these sort of cautionary tales. It feels like they almost function like an Aesop's Fables, like a modern Aesop's Fables, where these stories hopefully inspire a kind of lesson or sort of inspire us to be better humans or inspire us to consider these animals in their own stories. And I think that endlings are a way of putting that kind of character, putting a face, a persona onto something that's really abstract. So when you kicked off the segment, you pointed out that estimates put about 150 species a day going extinct. And I personally think that that's really hard to wrap my mind around, that that's a really, it's horrible, but it's very abstract. But when I dig into the story of Benjamin the Thylacine or Lonesome George the Galapagos tortoise, suddenly I feel like I have an understanding that simply statistics and numbers don't necessarily provide.
Talking to Lydia Pine about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. You can join in with your thoughts, your concerns about endangered species, your question for our guest about this concept of endlings, the last of a species. 800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join in. 800-642-1234. I want to meet some of the endlings. And you just mentioned one, Benjamin the Thylacine or Tasmanian tiger, some people call him. First of all, tell us a little bit about this species.
Sure. So the species, the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, I think in some literatures, they're also called Tasmanian wolves or hyenas, was a species that was common in Australia and Tasmania about 2 million years ago. And up through Europe, and it slowly goes extinct over the Australian mainland. And then by the time European settlers reach Tasmania, there are about 5,000 thylacines on the island of Tasmania. European settlers hunt the thylacine to extinction. It's really quite a vicious sort of extinction event in the 19th and early 20th century. And eventually, the last thylacine, the last known thylacine, is a captive thylacine that we've come to call Benjamin, who lived in a zoo in Hobart until he died in 1936 from exposure from the elements. It's really quite a tragic death to a sad extinction event.
Right. I got to say, in the storytelling here, and I'm putting human terms on an animal, which we do it, it seemed very undignified. Like the last member of the species was treated with very little dignity. Can you talk about that?
It feels oftentimes, I think, really cruel. And I think that it also helps us to really put actions and consequences together. Again, having a character or a persona or a specific individual, I think, helps us understand the actions and consequences in ways that I think are more abstract when we talk about bigger populations or species in general.
And Benjamin, I mean, the story that ends up being told about this thylacine, this Tasmanian tiger, first of all, he wasn't Benjamin. And I don't think, if I read right, he wasn't a he.
Yeah, so the debate is kind of open as to whether he is a he or whether whether he's called Benjamin at all. And historical records seem to point that while Benjamin was alive, he wasn't called Benjamin, and that this is sort of a myth, a story that gets built up in the years after Benjamin's death. And I think today it's impossible to talk about this individual without sort of having this myth, this story of Benjamin that gets built up after his death as part of that. And so one of the interesting parts, I think, about the story of Benjamin is how this last individual really spurs on conservation efforts in the late 20th century in Tasmania, in Australia. And Benjamin, such that he is, becomes this icon and this sort of focal point.
We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, about the stories of endlings, the last individuals of a species amid the Earth's sixth mass extinction. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this current, what appears to be mass extinction? Do you think humans should do more to prevent the extinction of species? Is there a particular threatened species or one we've lost that you've been particularly interested in that you feel a connection to for one reason or another? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Lydia Pine, looking at her book, Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, about endlings, the word for the last living individual of a species that goes extinct, and how we think about them, how we tell their stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your examples, a species of particular concern to you if you want to bring it up. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own stories if you've worked on conservation. Let's bring on a caller now. Joshua is with us in Viroqua. Joshua, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Joshua?
Yeah, so the late great passenger pigeons. Such an amazing story, and I was wondering if your guest writer had any stories about those endlings.
Joshua, thanks for the call. I don't think you have a chapter on the passenger pigeon. I don't know if we know about the last exact member of it. We've got, as I mentioned earlier, a memorial to the passenger pigeon, which once, I guess, filled the skies of North America and is now gone. Any thoughts, Lydia?
Sure. So Martha is actually the endling, the passenger pigeon endling. And there are many memorials to Martha and sort of marking this last of a species. What's really interesting, I think, about the story of Martha is that she's widely recognized, even at the point of her death and her species extinction, she's recognized as this last of her kind, but the word endling doesn't exist yet to be able to ascribe to her, to describe her. And so the endling part of her story, I think, is one that comes much later in the 20th century. A sort of interesting factoid about Martha that I learned when I was digging into endling stories is the zoo where Martha died actually had the last two Carolina parakeets, the endling and almost endling. They were called Incas and Lady Jane. And so... It's sort of an interesting coincidence that one place that's doing bird conservation work ends up with two last endlings.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's stay with birds for a moment. We had a parakeet in North America, in the United States, actually, a long time ago, the Carolina parakeet. Can you tell us about the story of what you call a charismatic endling?
I think that it is an incredibly charismatic endling and an incredibly charismatic bird. So as I mentioned, the last two endlings end up in the Cincinnati Zoo. They're Incas and Lady Jane, and they're purportedly devoted to each other. And in the tellings of these endling stories, Lady Jane dies first, and the zookeepers and conservators and curators all say that Incas had died of a broken heart and that's finally what finished him off. And I read these stories and I thought, oh my goodness, this just feels almost Arthurian in its telling, that you have this hero that's dying of a broken heart. And I felt like that was a really interesting way to think about and to frame this last Carolina parakeet.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in Barneveld. Bill, hello.
Hi, great program. Taking my call. Preservation based here in the Salaw Foundation, which is working to save what's probably the most endangered large mammal in the world now, a thing called the Salaw. This looks kind of like an antelope. It was only discovered in Vietnam in 1992. You know, I get asked, you know, why are you guys trying to do this? I mean, there's not many of these things left. What's the point of saving this? And I just like to weigh in with an answer I often give, or my perspective is, you know, people never ask, say, the curators at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, why are you doing this? Why are you saving Van Gogh's paintings? Well, they're saving because it's this beautiful thing, his paintings, these beautiful things in the world. And the world would be much less rich without them. And the same thing for the Salaw. It's this amazingly beautiful animal. And simply its beauty, that's enough reason for us. We don't have to make, you know, ecosystem economic arguments to say that just having this animal in the world a bit longer even if we never get a chance to see it ourselves, makes the world a richer and better place.
So, Bill, thanks for that call. That's the Saola. I looked it up, S-A-O-L-A. What do you think of Bill's motivation, Lydia?
Oh, my goodness. That was so beautifully put. I really appreciated him sharing his experience, and I really liked the analogy that he offered. That was really fantastic.
Thanks for calling in, Bill, at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us now in Ann Arbor. Tony, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I think that there's really not a lot of debate that we are the most invasive species on Earth. And I think that with our presence, we've caused a lot of other species to die off, or endlings. And I think we're missing a great opportunity to redirect our focus instead of trying to save the planet from global climate change, that we should just give palliative care to the people that are here now and just let us go the way of the dinosaurs and let the Earth recover after she rids herself of us.
Tony, thanks for the call. Lydia, a very drastic solution, eliminate humans from the picture. I'm guessing, I don't know, I'm assuming you're not going to jump on board with that, but short of that, do you think there's more we could do?
I think that one of the points that I think Tony raised is really interesting, in that the sort of, how do we think about bearing responsibility? And in digging through endling stories and in digging through how we talk about extinction, I think that there's definitely space for humans to assume the blame for harm that we have caused.
Tony, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lydia Pine is with us. We're talking about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. She looks at stories of the last members of species that have gone extinct and the stories we tell about them and why we tell them. Lydia, it seems to me this would be a tough project to do, right? I mean, I look at these stories and I honestly kind of want to look away. It's kind of painful and hard to confront. What kept you going to confront these stories?
It felt like, so I wrote the book during the pandemic, during the sort of first part of the pandemic, and it felt like a way to channel frustration. It felt like a way to talk about things that I felt were really hard. It felt like a way to talk about grief. But one of the other things that sort of inspired the project and spurred it on was reading a new translation of Beowulf by Maria Davanna Headley, who uses the word extinct in her translation to talk about what it is for this warrior to be the last person that survives this battle. And that moment was such an inspiration in what could literature tell us about thinking about loss and grief and the last of their kind, that I really wanted to find ways to explore that with non-human species.
Now, not all non-human species are, I guess, photogenic or charismatic. Can you make the case that we should be thinking about the other species that may not tug at our heartstrings, that may not have that sympathetic story?
Yeah, so I can actually offer like a personal experience that was a really humbling one when I put it together. So in the book, I talk about a plant called a woods cycad. It looks sort of like a palm tree. They're not palm trees, but they look kind of like palm trees. And there's only one plant, only one of wood cycad that's in the world. But because it's a clone, there are several copies of it in various botanical gardens around the world. And I realized when I was tracking down sort of at each point, where would these individuals be, these multiple endlings, where would they be? And I realized I had actually seen one in person and hadn't realized it. And it was such a humbling, experience to think, wow, because this isn't a charismatic rhinoceros or it's not a charismatic megafauna, I didn't put it together, what I was seeing, the enormity of what I was seeing. And that to me was a really sobering way of understanding the role that charisma can have in species that we care about and what species stories we talk about.
Time for one more caller. Willie is with us on the line in Madison. Willie, hi.
Hi. Years ago, it was probably in the 70s, I was at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. There I saw a stuffed whooping crane, and the little caption on the bird said, "There are only about 15 of the individuals of this species remaining, and the species will most certainly go extinct within the next few decades." Well, interestingly enough, I flew an airplane down to the little airport on the lake in downtown Chicago, and I flew back, and on my way flying back, I saw a flock of cranes with a few whooping cranes in it. And I realized that, you know, they talked about down to 15 in the species number at that time, and that it would go extinct. It did not.
Willie, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left. Wisconsin, Baraboo, Wisconsin, the International Crane Foundation, a big part of whooping crane revival efforts. Lydia, Willie pointed toward a case where we came back from the brink.
I love that. It sort of offers, I think, a balance to the sadness, the trauma, and the grief that we often associate with endlings and with extinction. It's exciting to hear of success stories, I think.
Thanks for that call, Willie and Lydia. We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lydia Pine is a writer and historian. She talked with us about her most recent book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, about the last living individuals of a species and how we talk about them, how we tell their stories. Still time for you to share your thoughts. If you have experiences like some of our other callers, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Interest rates continue to rise, and that's causing the housing market to cool off from the intense demand it saw for much of the pandemic. Now, some economists say we're in a housing recession, but is that really going to make a difference for people looking to buy, sell, or rent here in Wisconsin? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in the real estate market where you live? Are there fewer for sale signs in the neighborhood these days? Have you been looking to buy or sell a home? How is it going? Any realtors out there, what are you seeing in your line of work in your part of the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt Paulson is a professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
All right. I'm seeing this phrase thrown around, housing recession. What would that mean? And part two, are we in one?
Well, just like the discussion of the macroeconomy, there are signs that show, yes, we are in a recession, but there is an equal number of data points that show that no, we are not. Right. So in the macroeconomy, we have two successive quarters of negative GDP growth, which is the standard definition of a recession. But unemployment keeps going down and wage growth keeps going up. So that does not look like a recession. So in the housing world, we had three reports recently that all say we're in a housing recession. So the National Association of Home Builders does this forward-looking inventory where they interview their members. And for the first time in years, that turned negative. The National Association of Realtors reports that home sales and home starts, meaning building permits and new construction, those are down. And then Goldman Sachs said we should expect that sales and new construction will also keep going down all the way through 2023. On the other hand, prices are still astronomically high. So even if the rate of growth might have slowed down a little bit in the last couple of months, we're still looking at a housing market that has a lack of inventory, a lack of supply, and high prices. So if you already own your home and don't want to move, things are fine. But if you're looking to move or you're looking to buy for the first time, things are still pretty expensive.
I want to get into some of the factors going on here. Interest rates, we know the Federal Reserve's interest rates, they've been bumping it up. Has that been translating into mortgage interest rates going up?
Yep, absolutely. So if people are interested in tracking mortgage interest rates, Freddie Mac has a great website. And you can see that from January until today, the average 30-year fixed rate mortgage, that's the traditional mortgage that most people have, went from 3.22% to 5.55%. So let's translate that to a person who wanted to buy the median priced house in Wisconsin. That's about a $280,000 house. That means that for the same mortgage, your mortgage payment per month is up over $300 just in the last 6 months. So what that means is for your average home buyer, their purchasing power goes a lot less far, because for the same income, you can afford a lower amount of your mortgage because the interest rate is higher. Add that onto the increasing cost of housing, and it's what we call a double whammy. That's a technical term. Your dollar goes less far to buy something that's more expensive.
Okay, but go ahead.
And that's why we see home sales decline and new home starts also decline significantly in the last 6 months relative to 2021, which was a banner year.
Now, last time I talked to you, you were talking about a five-alarm fire when it comes to housing, largely driven by a lot of demand for housing, not a lot of supply for housing. I mean, I don't think those two things have really changed, so wouldn't there be an incentive to still keep building new houses?
There absolutely is an incentive. So maybe we're down to only a four-alarm fire. But here's how it would work. So if you're a current homeowner like me, and you're looking to downsize, maybe a condo or a townhouse once the kids leave so you don't have to shovel, you're looking around, and instead of a $300,000 house to buy, that new house is going to cost you $400,000 because of the construction costs. So on the one hand, my purchasing power is down because interest rates are up. So I currently have a good mortgage at less than 3%. To buy a new house, any new home buyer or someone who wants to move, you have to get a new mortgage at the higher rate. So millions of people around the country who might otherwise buy homes are just staying put. And that might mean that there's fewer houses to turn over. So it's again important to say the cost of existing housing will go up when the cost of building new housing goes up. So the cost to build a new home in the last 2 years has gone up at least 37%. So again, instead of a $300,000 house, maybe you're talking about a $400,000 house. So that's just going to lower the number of houses that people can afford to buy. And what I said last time is still true. If we want to bring down the cost of housing, we have to build new housing. But we can't bring down the cost of housing by building new until we can bring down the cost of building new housing. And that's going to take at least 3 to 4 years, I'm guessing, even though we're starting to see some relaxation of the supply chain constraints. Lumber prices are still high. Developers and builders can't get appliances. And what compounds this is a labor shortage. You talk to anyone in construction, they just can't get enough skilled labor to build the houses.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, talking about the housing market in Wisconsin and beyond. A lot going on here as we're hearing mortgage rates going up. Prices still staying pretty high, but maybe there's a housing recession where I'm building new houses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll love to hear from people who build houses or would build houses if you could find people to build them and stuff to build them with. What are you seeing out there? If you are buying, selling, or making a very conscious decision to stay put, maybe until things settle down, love to hear your story. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt, I know an ongoing concern of yours and something you research is the idea of workplace housing. If I want to work in this community and I want to live in, or at least close to this community, can I find a place to live there? What are you seeing going on around Wisconsin now?
So as you point out, if you have a job opening, if you're an employer or a county economic development official, and you have jobs opening, but you have no housing, or the housing that is available is extremely expensive, it's very hard to recruit workers to come to your area. I'm sure you've seen the news recently. Sheboygan County had 3,000 jobs open, and their housing vacancy rate is close to zero. So they, even if they could get people to move there, there's nowhere for them to live. And this just makes it harder to recruit and retain your workforce. And it also means that if people are feel stuck, so they want to stay in their current house, then maybe they don't have the capacity to move one county over or move to another state for perhaps a better job opportunity. So it works both against employers being able to recruit, but also for job seekers to be able to move.
Is there a creative solution if I'm, you know, in planning in Sheboygan County, or if I'm an employer in Sheboygan County, I'd sure like to bring those workers in and find them a place to live. And I don't want to wait 3 hours or 3 years, I'm sorry, for the price of lumber to come down. Is there something I could do in the short run?
Well, there's not a lot you can do in the short run, because even if you waved a magic wand and got zoning approval to build lots of housing and new single family homes, those would take 18 months to build. You can't get the labor. So the creative solutions are factory built housing or manufactured housing, which we can deliver. But even those are subject to production delays. So one of the interesting things Sheboygan County is doing is they're just deciding to get into the housing business themselves and build some units themselves. But again, it takes financing and it takes construction and it takes time.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. James is with us here in Wisconsin. James, hi.
Hello. Yeah, my opinion on this thing is, when you're paying, you know, for example, $15 an hour to work at McDonald's, what does that do to the cost of labor for skilled laborers? I know people right now that are roofing that won't get on top of a roof for under $40 an hour. And it's been quite ridiculous, some of the prices of labor, what people expect now. So these people with the skilled labor are looking for other work.
And James, do you work in construction trades yourself?
I've been in construction my entire life, and I thoroughly enjoy it. It just doesn't pay like it used to. You know, $20 an hour, $25 an hour, 10, 15 years ago, it used to be a good wage. And nowadays, it just isn't. You're just not going to get a labor force for that kind of money.
James, thanks a lot for sharing that firsthand example. Kurt, this is part of the labor costs you were talking about earlier.
Exactly. And as James knows, if you have to pay $40 for a roofer instead of $20, and you have to pay for your framers and your HVAC people, in addition, even if you could get the materials at the same price, a 20 or 30% increase in labor, that's going to drive up the cost of an average house $30,000 to $40,000. So here again, we think that high wages is generally good, particularly for workers. But if we want to deliver housing at a lower price point, then something has to give. Either the cost of materials has to go down, or the cost of land and infrastructure has to go down, or the cost of labor has to go down. And none of those are easy levers to maneuver in the short run to affect our housing prices.
Thanks for that call, James. We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about what's going on in the housing market a lot and whether we're in a housing recession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in development, realty, related fields, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're in the market to sell or buy a house, or maybe putting that on hold for a while, tell us your story. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about a housing recession, maybe, in the United States right now, and what's going on in the housing scene here in Wisconsin. Kurt Paulson with UW-Madison stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Kim is with us in near Madison. Kim, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a property manager in the Madison and surrounding areas. Last year, we built a 57-unit building, and now I'm just finishing up a construction of a 37-unit. And I tell you, the costs have more than tripled. You know, it's tough to as a landlord and watching these owners, you know, afford it and then make affordable housing for our renters. And I also want to curtail that I agree 100%. Trying to find a vendor, getting appliances, everything is just an incredible struggle right now. And I this is a good topic because it needs to be addressed.
Kim, thanks for that call, Kim. Kurt, a lot of times if you can't buy a house, you rent a house. Well, Kim says same factors are driving up the cost of rent too.
Exactly, right? And we have two forces also driving up rents. In the first instance, as Kim pointed out, to build new rental housing is also 35 to 40% more expensive just on the input costs. So either you don't build that housing because you can no longer make that project cash flow, or you have to raise the rents to cover the additional costs. And as you pointed out, there's a large number of potential home buyers who have stayed in the rental market because they can no longer afford an entry-level home or they can't save for the down payment. So they stay in rental markets, which puts pressure on rents. So nationwide, rents have grown more than 10% year over year in the last couple of months. And we would expect that you're going to have continued strong rent growth and rental demand because of the factors we talked about earlier. That means that for your lower wage workers or people at the lower end of the wage scale, you are seeing your rents go up 10 or 15%, which is a real problem for affordability because your income has not gone up 10 or 15%. We say that in a housing market, all of the bad stuff trickles down to the lower end of the wage scale. So renters who make less than $15 an hour are really stressed right now.
Thanks for the call, Kim. Cheryl joins us next in Rice Lake. Cheryl, hello.
Hello. So my mentioned about housing being available in the cities, you know, won't even bring a person in because there's no place to go. We have the same situation in Rice Lake. And what our situation, actually what I see locally, is our housing is getting snatched up by people who are using it for short-term rental or vacation property.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. You hear that in big cities sometimes, Kurt. I've heard it in places like Door County and other places that rely on tourism a lot. People can't afford to live there, they say, because the Airbnbs and VRBOs are owners are buying things up.
Right. Or we see investors buying housing to turn it into rental, for long-term rental. And again, in a really tight housing market, when you have institutional actors or Airbnbs or bulk purchasers, even 1% or 2% of the market, you can really constrain supply and availability. And so a first-time home buyer who might be using something like FHA or a Veterans Administration loan, you're going to be outcompeted by someone who's going to be an all-cash buyer without contingencies. So again, the long-run solution is to build more housing so that there's more competition with Airbnb and investor-owned single family. But in the short run, that's really putting a price pressure in our markets, as Cheryl pointed out.
Thanks for the call, Cheryl. Steber joins us now in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi.
My comment
is simply that a lot of people don't want 2,000, 3,000 square foot houses, but the builders only want to build big houses because they make more money. I had a little bitty job to do this summer, but it was too little. So I'm doing it myself.
Wow. Thanks for the call. Kurt, is this a problem we don't have? It's not just we don't have enough housing. We don't have like the size people want, say, like you were talking about earlier, if somebody wants to downsize after the kids go.
Yes, exactly. We don't build a lot of the smaller houses on smaller lots or the attached housing like a townhouse or a duplex, which would really meet that entry-level price point, that first-time homebuyer price point, or move-down housing for seniors. So again, if a senior moves out of a large single-family house into a condo or a townhouse, then they recycle that larger home for young families. But I want to disagree at least half of what she said, that I don't think it's the fact that builders only want to build large, expensive homes. I think it's also driven by zoning. If the zoning ordinance says you can only build a single family house on a large lot, like 10,000 square feet, then your land costs and your infrastructure costs are so high that the only way a developer can make a reasonable return is to build a large home with high-end finishings to pay for those land and infrastructure costs. So if cities were to allow a much larger supply of townhouses, small lot houses, maybe duplexes or houses closer together, I think you would see many developers who want to build at that affordable, smaller price point. But obviously what we've talked about earlier, you're still not going to build anything affordable, even if it's a small house on a small lot, as long as construction costs are as high as they are right now.
Thanks for that call. Kurt, one thing I've seen is some cities have tackled their zoning. I think Minneapolis is one, some on the West Coast, to try to allow more for, you know, the so-called mother-in-law suite or something like that, you know, a separate unit. Maybe it's an attic unit or an outbuilding on a house. Do you see those making a difference in housing supply and maybe in the future bringing the cost down?
Yes, but that will take a long time, and that's a small portion of the market. So again, if you look at a city like Madison, which is making it easier to build those accessory dwelling units, that will relax some of the supply constraints just a little bit. But in a really tight market like we have in Madison, it's not going to have a whole lot of impact on price. But again, as you pointed out, we want to create not just different prices, but a different variety of housing to meet the needs of all different family sizes and age groups. And so anything we can do to relax the housing supply will help us over the long run to bring down the cost of housing. But nobody expects that the median price of a single family house is going to fall all that much, even if you drastically increase supply, just because we continue to have very strong demand for housing.
And just our last half a minute, Kurt, what is the biggest open question on your mind right now when it comes to housing?
Well, if I was really smart and could forecast where housing would go, I would invest one side or the other. I think house prices are going to stay high for the next 5 years. And it has this ratchet effect where until you can bring down the cost of new construction and significantly deliver lots of new housing, you're going to continue to have entry-level homeownership affordability challenges and a real stress on the rental market. And absent some major new federal policy, sorry to end on bad news, but I think things will get a little bit worse before they get better.
Kurt, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. He was with us today to talk about housing in the United States, whether we're in a housing recession, and why that doesn't mean housing prices, he says, are likely to come down anytime soon.